Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the standoff in Oregon between a self-declared group of armed patriots who have occupied government buildings and the FBI, who are exercising patience and restraint. Thomas Makaitis, a professor of history at DePaul University, who has taught counterterrorism courses as part of the Department of Defense Counterterrorism Fellowship Program, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, "Stop Calling Terrorists Militiamen," and the double standard of white extremists playing soldiers in the Oregon woods, who are at best criminals and at worst domestic terrorists, and Black Lives Matter and Occupy protesters who, if armed, would provoke a much more aggressive response from the authorities. Then we'll speak with Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations, Mansour Farhang, a professor of international relations at Bennington College, about the growing confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia, where on both sides, hardliners want to distract the domestic discontent of their restive publics facing economic hardship by stoking nationalist fervor. And following the execution of a prominent Shiite cleric by the Saudis, we'll also discuss the abysmal human rights records on both sides, with Saudi Arabia having executed 168 people last year, while Iran conducted 694 executions of mostly political prisoners. Then finally, we'll look into the appalling human rights situation in Saudi Arabia, where any criticism of the king could result in death, and where anti-terrorism laws are used to stifle any dissent and justify capital punishment that usually involves beheading but can include crucifixion. Sarah Whitson, the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, joins us to discuss the Saudi government's disregard for human rights, while at the same time it spends hundreds of millions on public relations efforts to improve its international image. And joining us now is Thomas Makaitis, who's a professor of history at DePaul University. He has taught counterterrorism courses for the past 13 years at venues around the world as part of the U.S. Department of Defense Counterterrorism Fellowship Program, and is the author of 6 books, including New Terrorism, Myths and Reality. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, "Stop Calling Terrorists Militiamen." Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Makaitis.
Thank you.
And the terrorists, the domestic terrorists you're referring to, are of course these so-called patriots who have descended upon a wildlife refuge in Oregon in defense of a couple of ranchers who are about to go to prison on arson charges. The ranchers themselves have distanced themselves, as far as I can tell, from this group of gun-toting patriots. Mm. My understanding, your point is well taken, that these people are domestic terrorists and they shouldn't be dignified by calling them militiamen. But essentially, Clive and Bundy, the father of two of them, he's actually a moocher. I mean, these are parasites. These are people who refuse to pay grazing rights to the federal government. So they're sort of, for all of their so-called patriotism, they're basically, you know, parasites on the taxpayer's dime.
Well, the way that they would explain that is they're part of something, you know, loosely that's been referred to as the sovereign citizens movement, which is they really don't recognize the authority of the federal government except in very limited ways. And they have this almost kind of, you know, idyllic notion that only, you know, self-acknowledged groups of local citizens can regulate themselves and so on. So it's part of an ideology that reflects that authority, and they just simply don't accept that, you know, for example, the Bureau of Land Management has a right to, to assert any authority over them. And they really, you know, they would challenge, if they could, all kinds of things, taxation and the power of the police and everything else. And that's why I said what I said in pretty strong terms. And a lot of people have come back and said, well, you know, they haven't hurt anybody. Well, if you look at the Department of Defense definition of terrorism, the threat of violence is in itself an act of terror. And that's what you have here.
Well, it does seem that they're threatening violence, these so-called patriots, mm-hmm. and the federal government is being very, very low-key. The FBI seem to be – they don't want to provoke an incident, another Waco, for example. Yeah. Is that your reading on it?
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, it is – you know, there's a certain – I mean, the irony, the bitter irony of how much – some of these people resemble ISIS is truly remarkable, in the sense that there is an element of martyrdom. There is an element of they are the true representatives of everybody else, even when people disown them. Theirs is the only correct view of what the Constitution and American citizenship means. So they, into some of them, would like nothing better than an armed confrontation. The militia movement took a lot of strength, and Waco was badly handled, so was Ruby Ridge, Idaho. But so the authorities are being very careful, and they're being wise. I mean, no one is at the moment in danger. It's winter. There's nobody particularly up there. They're in a contained area. They're sealed off. The best thing, they have no hostages. All of the indicators are that there's no pressing need to do anything except wait them out. Now, the real challenge is that once they do, to allow this crime to go unprosecuted, I think, would be a mistake. But I'm glad that nobody's looking to go in and, you know, because that's exactly what they want.
Well, in terms of their not paying taxes and being sovereign citizens, and obviously by that definition, the rest of us are a bunch of suckers that we actually subsidize them. You know what? It does seem a little self-serving, doesn't it? If you can graze your cattle on public lands for free when other people have to pay for it, then it's all very well to dress it up in lofty revolutionary rhetoric. But to my mind, you know, it's pretty self-serving.
Well, and that's a valid point. Not only do they benefit from the grazing land, but they benefit from the infrastructure in the United States and the security provided by the federal government and the roads and everything else. So, yeah, there's no question that there's a strong element of it being self-serving. To be fair, you know, fair is the wrong word. I have no sympathy for these people. But if you want to understand them, you try to get inside their head. I don't have much doubt that they genuinely believe that they are, you know, the heirs. This is why I gave the mini history lesson in that blog post, was to say these are the heirs. They think themselves the heirs of the original militiamen, but the militiamen operated under a significant degree of discipline and were only effective when they really were brought under federal authority or state authority. And these guys have no authority at all except themselves. But that's the nature of the ideological dimension of any kind of extremist belief system, is their point of reference is themselves and those who agree with them. And anybody else doesn't get it. That's quite literally how they dismiss them.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Makaitis, who's a professor of history at DePaul University. He's taught counterterrorism courses for the past 13 years at venues around the world as part of the U.S. Department of Defense Counterterrorism Fellowship Program, and is the author of 6 books, including New Terrorism, Myths and Reality. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Stop Calling Terrorists Militiamen. And in terms of the little history lesson that you referred to in your article at the Huffington Post, of course, the Second Amendment, which is often quoted, of course, by people similar or with similar aims and beliefs as these so-called patriots. The well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right to the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Of course,
right.
The Heller decision a little while back turned that on its head. Obviously, it always, I think to reasonable people, a well-regulated militia was the predicate, and the citizens' right to bear arms was in that context. The Supreme Court turned that around. How much do you think the fact that we are in a country where we have the best armed terrorists and the best armed criminals in the world with free access to high-powered military weapons plays a part in this?
Well, it does. It creates an atmosphere of paranoia that, you know, the answer of what you get from people who are extreme gun right advocates are every time there's a shooting incident, it means we need more guns, not fewer. You know, we need to have, if there's a shooting incident in school, we need to have armed guards in the school. If we have a shooting incident on a college campus, we need to have armed students, which would be a nightmare. But the irony of this, too, is if you go back from your state of California back to the 1960s, the people who were arguing for the right to bear arms were the Black Panthers, and the person opposing them was Governor Ronald Reagan. You say context is an incredibly important kind of thing. So, you know, this has shifted the ground. And I think this is the other thing to me, which is, I wrote another piece this morning on the same HuffPost about why the terrorism label fits. And there's also a visceral thing, too. If the Black Lives Matter movement or the Occupy Wall Street movement, if those people showed up to their demonstrations as heavily armed as these people are, you can be sure there would be a strong response. And the very same people who call these guys militias and support them, in fact, you know, would be the ones screaming that we needed to use force against them. So, I mean, you know, there's a very large social and, you know, ideological context to all of this, which you have to make sense of it.
Well, of course, the president is about to issue an executive order trying to cover up the secondary market, through which I think at least 40% of firearms are sold. And I think he's going to extend the government licensing program to fill that gun show loophole. But it is a bit odd, isn't it, when you see the president acting out of frustration because of a Congress that's pretty much owned by the National Rifle Association. And on the one hand, you've got Bloomberg and a bunch of mayors and others trying to bring about what they call gun safety. And then you've got the state of Texas allowing open carry. And now you see people wandering around with assault rifles shopping at Kmart. It's
pretty. It is, exactly. And the thing is, what's interesting to me is I'm not, you know, is it the most reasonable people, ironically, to tell, well, I don't know if it's ironic, maybe it isn't, to talk to about guns are hunters. They tend to be very well trained, they tend to be safety conscious, and they tend to want reasonable access. I mean, hunters have said, well, I say, how many bullets do you have in a gun when you hunt even big game? They'll go 2 to 3. Because they need to keep track of them. They don't want armor-piercing bullets. They don't need multiple round clips. They don't need 50-caliber sniper rifles. There's an element of reasonableness that has to come in here. And no question, but this is, you know, the more you create this climate of fear, the more you're afraid, you know, the more people are afraid, the more this just feeds on itself. That, you know, there are so many guns out there, so many criminals, I have to protect myself. Even though the police, last time I checked, most police are not flaming liberals. Even they are coming out saying, look, the last thing, we want you to call us. We don't want you to try to defend your own house. That's a formula for a tragedy.
So in terms of the double standard that you just pointed out, which is, goes back to the Black Panthers bearing arms in a showdown, I believe it was on the campus of UC Berkeley, when I think Reagan might have been the regent then or governor, but in any case, I recall all of that. And when you made the point that if the Black Lives Matter movement or other groups were to show up at rallies bearing arms like they do down in Texas and these characters in Oregon are doing at the moment, that would likely to incite a real shootout. What explains that double standard, apart from the obvious, which is racism?
I've thought a lot about that, and I think what it is, at a very visceral level, it's given, you know, the history of race in America, maybe just the way people, you know, are constructed in terms of identifying them and us, is that there's a sense in which a terrorist is somebody not like you. You know, they're supposed to be dark-skinned and a different religion. And I don't know how else to put that politely, but I think it's true. They're very willing to say, you know, the Muslims are terrorists and we have to worry about Syrians and so on. But when it's a white Christian, then you trot out all of the special terms. Oh, you know, this person was disturbed, this person is not typical, this person is exceptional, or in this case, this person is part of a legitimate citizen militia movement. It, you know, the rhetoric gets turned on its head, and the real message beneath it is, you know, people like us can't be terrorists. People who look like me, believe like me, can't be terrorists. We've got to call them something else.
Yeah, but if you or I went into a federal building armed to the teeth with assault rifles and said, you know, we're occupying it and now we're the true sovereign citizens and you're the illegitimate government, how long do you think it would be before the FBI and a SWAT team would come and remove
before
us?
Before we got carried out in body bags.
Yeah.
You know, again, if we were acting as I think nowadays there is, you know, a lot of wisdom that has come out of the tragedies like Ruby Ridge and like Waco and so on. But they would genuinely try to defuse it. I mean, there's really good, you know, they don't get into it unless they have to, the way they did San Bernardino, where the people are returning fire and you just don't have a choice. But on the other hand, they wouldn't tolerate it. No, I mean, if people took over a building in downtown Chicago, they took over one in downtown L.A. There would be a quick response. Now, this happens to be an area where they can they can isolate it and there isn't the urgency. But I think I've kind of forgotten the number of interviews I've done, but somebody asked me today about the question of, does this embolden them? Well, that's a valid point. That's why I say, when the dust settles, these individuals do need to be arrested and prosecuted. To not do that, I think, would be a terrible mistake.
Well, but the patriarch of the two that are leading this, yeah. Clive and Bundy, his two sons are sort of pretty much leading this group of so-called militiamen. Yeah. He essentially got away with it. He hasn't paid that $1 million fine or million dollars that he owes the government. So it's not as if the government's really ever come down that hard on any of them. You know, I mean,
I think that's a mistake. And I think, you know, absolutely right. And I think in part, it's because of the fear of backlash. But the other piece of it, too, is Bundy was, to some degree, enjoyed some popularity from even, you know, right-wing mainstream politicians until he made the racial remarks that he did, implying apparently that I don't have the exact wording, but, you know, that African Americans would be better off as slaves or something, and then people distance themselves from him. But, you know, to some degree, this is the nature of extreme rhetoric, too. It shades into the legitimate. If you look at some of the political discourse, this anti-government feeling that is being stirred up by some presidential candidates, you know, that the government's out of control, the government's too big, the government's infringing on our liberties, the government this, you know, they're not themselves advocating violence, but it does stimulate this other extreme group that is more likely to do that. So it's a very unhealthy brew that we're concocting here that is, that is behind a lot of this. It's not unlike people who will say, abortion's wrong, abortion's evil, abortion doctors are murderers, and then when somebody goes and kills one of them or shoots up a clinic or something, they'll say, oh, but I didn't have anything to do with that. Well, you kind of did. And I think that's the other background to this that we have to look at.
So does that explain Ted Cruz and Dr. Ben Carson's intervention here, calling upon these so-called militia men to cool it?
Well, I think that, you know, it may. And I mean, to their credit, they're being responsible, and I'm glad they are. I wish they would take the next step and be asking the tough question, is there anything that I'm saying that is encouraging this? But if they're coming out and saying, look, you know, this is not what I want you to be doing, and certainly to the credit of the men who were going back to jail for this arson crime, which, you know, I mean, the other thing is, and I don't profess to know all the details of it, you know, there's a legitimate reason to maybe protest. I can understand people saying, look, they were doing a free burn to clear invasive species. Yeah, they violated the law. Is this really something you want to put them in jail for 5 years for? Is there more to it? I don't know. But the thing is, if you want to show up and protest peacefully, which some people did, that's okay. You don't need to show up with guns. When you do that and you invite others to join you and you say, we're willing to fight and kill, that's when you've crossed the line.
Well, the father and son who are going to, I think they're reporting to jail in California as we speak.
Yeah.
It does seem that the original judge in the case didn't think he thought the federal guidelines for sentencing them for what they were supposed to have done. And I believe the feds thought that they were not so much clearing land for grazing, but they were involved in illegal deer hunting.
Yeah.
The long and the short of it is that the judge thought that it was unreasonable to sentence them according to the guidelines and didn't, gave them a very light sentence. But the federal prosecutor, and I imagine this must be the U.S. attorney in Oregon, decided that they had to adhere to the guidelines and then resentenced them. And that's where they stand now. And there does seem to be an element of unfairness in this or overreach on the part of the federal government.
It may be, but to be fair, this strikes me as an iceberg issue. You know, what's the background? What else have they done? You know, there's a saying among prosecutors that prison is a lifetime achievement award. What else did these guys happen to do? Did they engage in any other activity or not? I just don't know. But the point is, you know, I would respect them protesting. This, however, is vigilanteism. This is just so over the top.
And indeed, according to the Bundys, the gun-toting Bundy boys up there in Oregon, they say they've been in private conversations with the two that are father and son that are the focus of this. So it does seem that there's maybe more collusion there than the two are admitting to. Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Thomas McCarthy.
Sure. I'm happy to have done it, and thanks for creating this forum and for including me.
Thank you again. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas McCarthy, who's a professor of history at DePaul University. He's taught counterterrorism courses for the past 13 years at venues around the world as part of the U.S. Department of Defense Counterterrorism Fellowship Program, and is the author of 6 books, including New Terrorism, Myths and Reality. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Stop Calling Terrorists Militiamen. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the growing confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Not a poor Ku Klux man, see that we all brothers. Not cause things the same, because we lack the same color. And that's grain, now that's man. Can't burn his cross, cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mansour Farhang, who's a professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release the U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War II, The Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour Farhang.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And is there a strategy on the part of Iran, or even you could ask the same question about Saudi Arabia? My understanding is that the al-Sauds are panicked and lashing out, and there's a 30-year-old king, or son of the king, who's running the place, who has not much education, has also got the country embroiled in a quagmire in Yemen. But on the other hand, why did the authorities in Tehran allow that embassy to be burned, or did it get out of their control? Is there a strategy here, or is this thing likely to spiral out of control?
There is a serious factional division within the Iranian regime. I was just reading the various Iranian newspapers in response to the incident, and some of them are explicitly or implicitly supporting the attack on the embassy, while others are criticizing it. On the one hand, Rouhani and his cabinet are very interested in normalizing Iran's trade relations with the rest of the world, even attracting foreign capital to the country that they desperately need. In order to do that, they want to create a secure environment in the country. While attacking on the embassy reminds people of what happened to American embassy, what happened to British embassy. This is the third time that the Iranian security forces have attacked the foreign embassy. So it's really an indication of the division within the Iranian regime and not a coherent strategy on the part of the totality of the Iranian regime.
So therefore, could this be symbiotic in the worst possible way? The young king and the ailing king, who has Alzheimer's, I understand, is under a lot of pressure. There's even within the al-Saud family, there's a lot of dissent about his mismanagement of the war in Yemen and all the money that's going out the window. So obviously, under those conditions, when you've got dissent at home, there's nothing like ginning up nationalism through war or threat of war. And the same possibly applies on the Iranian side, where the supreme leader and the hardliners are trying to contain the new president, who's made a deal with the West, who, as you mentioned, wants to open up the country. And they've been, you know, doing everything they can to stymie him by jailing journalists, etc. So nationalism also plays into their hands.
No question. You see, Saudi Arabia is a dictatorship, is a reactionary country from perspective of human rights, but nevertheless, it's a status quo country. It wants to preserve the present situation and protect the regime. Iran is also a dictatorship with a very dark history of human rights behavior, and yet it's a revolutionary country in the sense that it wants to promote its revolutionary ideas, and therefore Iran's influence in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen, as well as in southern Lebanon, creates a kind of sectarian confrontation which is unprecedented in the history of the region. The difference between the two is that Saudi Arabia is interested in protecting what is the status quo, and Iran is challenging it, except that, like other revolutionary regimes, this promotion of the Iranian revolution, or what they refer to as the export of the revolution, seems to have a growing material and human cost. And therefore, within the Iranian regime, there are some individuals, some powerful groups and individuals who are questioning it and challenging it. Not unlike what happened in the Soviet Union or in China or in Cuba. So it's really a situation that is very difficult to really consider one side to be the main cause of the problem. And then the right-wing elements, both in Iran and in Saudi Arabia, they actually support each other's perspectives. And there is no question in my mind that in Saudi Arabia, as well as in Iran, there are moderate elements who see the continuation of this conflict to have heavy costs for the security and economic situation of both countries. So we are really faced with a situation that ideologically driven foreign policy, you know, in Iran is creating resistance, and this sectarian Sunni Shi'i, it's being used as an ideology otherwise for centuries. There is always prejudice within this type of system, but this prejudice had never been so violent to the point that we are observing these days. So it means that if there was any hope that Iran and Saudi Arabia were going to cooperate to find a political solution for the civil wars in Yemen and in Syria, this confrontation, the end of diplomatic relationship between the two, is really damaging that possibility, which means a very negative development for American strategy in the region.
So just in terms of human rights issue here, because there's obviously been an outcry that's on the 2nd of January, just as the new year began, the Saudi regime executed 47 so-called terrorists, including this prominent Shiite cleric, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. But this year, this last year, Saudi Arabia executed 158 people, which was the highest number in recent history. But by comparison, Tehran executed 694 people last year. So there's no, obviously, in terms of human rights, they're both pretty abysmal, aren't they?
Absolutely. But Iran's condemnation of political execution in Saudi Arabia has no moral or legal credibility, because it has probably the worst record in the world since over the past 37 years, Iran has executed more political activists than any other country in the world. On the other hand, international human rights organizations, Western European countries, even the State Department, they have criticized Saudi Arabia, and that criticism from the human rights perspective makes perfect sense because of the opposition to capital punishment in general and political dissidents in particular. But regrettably, Iran doesn't really have any credibility to be a critic of Saudi Arabia. Nevertheless, because this Shi'i, the Ayatollah Sheikh, he studied in Iran. He was the promoter of Iranian revolution as well as the domination or the legitimate rule of the clerical rule in Iran. He was advocating it very openly. He was very close to the Iranians, and also among the Shi'i activists in Bahrain, in Lebanon, in Syria, as well as in Iran, he had some prestige. Therefore, his execution could help the Iranians to mobilize the Shiites against Saudi Arabia, as we, for example, witnessed in Iraq, that two Sunni mosques were attacked and burned down in response to that. But it's, Saudi Arabia is definitely discriminating against the Shiites, and so is Iran discriminating against the Sunnis. The Sunnis in Iran do not have the right to have their own mosque in major cities of the country. The only place where they can pray freely is in Kurdistan, where they are the majority of the population. And the Shiites of Iraq, in eastern province of Iraq, where the oil resources are located, they represent the majority of the population. And then when Sheikh Namir is really advocating secession from Saudi Arabia, the Saudis, but and also someone who has been somewhat educated and trained in Iran and very openly is a supporter of the Iranian version of Shi'i Islam, Saudis feel very threatened by that. So this, except that this clerical ruler was not really interested in human rights, he was only interested in questioning the legitimacy of the Saudi rulers. So the confrontation is really between factional groups or sectarian supporters of Shiism and Sunnism who have absolutely no respect for the idea of human rights. So from the perspective of human rights, both of them have no credibility whatsoever. But from the political standpoint, I would say Saudi Arabia is a status quo country, while Iran is a kind of aggressive, at least ideologically aggressive, exporter of revolution that threatens the status quo in the Arab world.
Well, Mansour Farang, it's often described the situation in the region as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and Syria, of course, is very much a flashpoint. Is there any possibility that there's also a hidden agenda here in terms of the setbacks that the Saudis suffered in Syria recently? I believe it was the Russians who killed a prominent militia leader who was basically the Saudi Arabia's guy. He was killed on the outskirts of Damascus and led one of the most effective rebel factions that the Saudis supported. Is there any tit for tat there, do you think?
You know, I doubt very much if there was any possibility, any hope for a progressive political settlement as a result of cooperation between Saudi Arabia and Iran that the United States has been promoting. Last time they met in Vienna, Secretary Kerry tried to get the Saudi and the Iranian foreign minister together, but I doubt very much it could, you know, continue. There is no way of thinking about any kind of settlement that is acceptable to various rebel groups in Syria and the Syrian government. It's really a tragedy. Any country in which over 250,000 people have been killed, half of the population have been displaced, 4 million externally, it's very hard to imagine a kind of settlement that is acceptable to both sides. It's a tragedy that could only end when one side or the other or both sides are exhausted.
Well, in terms of the standoff there between Saudi Arabia and Iran, we've mentioned the possibility that it could spiral out of control because there are hardline factions on both sides who want to distract the public, in the case of the Saudis, from the ailing economy, the 40% rise in gas, the fact that they've been buying off their people for the longest time with the largesse, which is drying up because of the low price of oil. And on the, as you mentioned, on the Iranian side, you've got this sort of factional war going on between the president, who's made this deal with the West, who wants to open the country up, and the Revolutionary Guards and the supreme leader and his son, I believe, is trying to have himself installed as the next supreme leader. They want to continue their revolution. So short of this spiraling into some kind of military confrontation, which one hopes doesn't happen, I imagine economic warfare will escalate, will it not? And Iran won't Iran be able to start pumping oil pretty soon and selling it and depressing the price even further?
It's possible. Iran has extensive economic relations with the Arab states of the Persian Gulf, and two of them have already ended the diplomatic relationship while indicating that the economic relationship will continue. I doubt very much that it could lead to a military conflict because Iran doesn't want that at all. Iran is aware that a military confrontation with Saudi Arabia, which means also military confrontation with the Arab states of the Persian Gulf, like Kuwait, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, it means it will bring the United States, particularly Bahrain. It means the Iran is fighting the United States. Therefore, even the hardliners in Iran do not really pursue a strategy which will lead to military, you know, clash. But they will suffer economically. There is no question about it. You know, Saudi Arabia has reserves, has over $700 billion reserves. It's possible for Saudi Arabia to actually continue with the low oil prices for another year. But for Iran, it is extremely difficult, particularly after the resolution of the nuclear dispute between the United States and Iran. There is a general expectation in the Iranian public that it will lead to improvement in their economic situation. And it is not happening because of the low oil prices and because of the insecurity in Iran, which prevent the foreign capital from investment and also modernization of the Iranian security, the Iranian the oil facilities that have not really been upgraded over the past 37 years. And the United States and Western European countries are the only ones that can go to Iran and improve the facilities that would increase Iranian oil production. But it's very doubtful that with the present position the Iranian regime is taking, that kind of capital is going to be attracted to Iran.
So just in closing then, Mansour Farhang, it sounds to me like on balance, the Saudis have more leverage, and not talking about hot war, but a cold war, but their greatest vulnerability surely is a sectarian division within the country where you've got the Shia in the eastern area where the oil fields are, who are oppressed and angry. So at the end of the day, it sounds like even though the Saudis may have the upper hand, as you've just described, Saudi Arabia's ultimate vulnerability is that the country could crack up.
But the Shiites, even though they're concentrated in the eastern province of Saudi, they represent a minority. They represent about 6% of the total in the population. So Saudi Arabia is able to suppress them. And also, there is a significant effort on the part of the Shiites of Saudi Arabia to work for improvement of the situation and to demand rights without really supporting Iran. Shiites of Saudi Arabia are not at all united in the sense of confronting the Saud family. There were a number of activists who are interested in reform, who want the Saudi government to change policies, but without really associating or identifying themselves with Iran or any revolutionary ideology. So we should not assume that the Shiites of Iraq, even though they are resentful of discrimination of the Saudi regime against them, but they are not at all united in terms of choosing the methods and the strategy of pursuing their rights. Particularly, they are not at all united, not even the majority of them still could be considered supporters or sympathetic to the Iranian regime.
Well, Mansour Farhang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mansour Farhang, who's a professor of international relations at Bennington College in Vermont. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release the U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War, To the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press and Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the appalling human rights situation in Saudi Arabia.
Done to me, we could never be free. I just want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sarah Whitson, who's the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Whitson.
Thank you for having me.
And your organization, Human Rights Watch, have said that last year Saudi Arabia executed 158 people, which was the most in recent history. And, of course, just on January the 2nd, 47 people were executed along with the Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, which has caused a tremendous backlash in the region. So do you have any understanding? I mean, obviously, the rest, most of them that were executed, I believe, were members of al-Qaeda, at least alleged members of al-Qaeda. It's pretty clear that the sheikh is a political prisoner as opposed to a criminal, if indeed these other that were executed are terrorists. So what's your understanding of, I mean, is there any, there's no transparency in the laws, right? I mean, the official law that he was charged with, Sheikh, is breaking allegiance with the ruler and inciting sectarian strife. Well, for God's sake, if anybody's inciting sectarian strife, it's the Saudi government.
No, that's right. I mean, he was also charged with resisting arrest, and he was charged with supporting rioting and destruction of public property, by which I think they mean that having called for demonstrations and protests, he was responsible for any rioting and destruction of property that occurred during the Shia protests in Saudi Arabia during 2011 and 2012. And that really goes to the heart of what's wrong with his conviction and execution and the conviction of so many political activists in Saudi Arabia, which is that merely expressing speech critical of the government, merely calling, speaking critically of the monarch and the ruling family is a capital offense by which you are guilty of terrorism under one of the few laws that exist in Saudi Arabia, which is the counterterrorism law.
So how far can you go in terms of expressing dislike for the government? I mean, just give me a sense of what the boundaries are. Is it that trivial that if you just said, I hate the king, he could be executed?
Well, it certainly you will go to jail, or you could easily go to jail if you say, I hate the king, simply on the basis of a tweet, simply by basis of speaking to media. I mean, any form of public speech that's openly critical of the government could very easily land you in jail. And obviously, it depends on who you are. It depends if you have a following. It depends on your prominence. They're unlikely to or even know about the average citizen who might express critical speech. But anyone with a platform, anyone with a voice, like Reif Badawi, who is a blogger and has a certain following, was convicted and sentenced to jail. This Palestinian poet who wrote poems that were deemed to be critical. Countless human rights activists, reformers, lawyers, even those who have promoted tolerance of Shia, but themselves are Sunnis, have ended up in jail. And sort of the two lightning rods that will end you up in jail in Saudi Arabia is criticizing the government or criticizing Islam. Those are the absolute red lines for the monarchy. But even criticizing the government in ways that we consider, ordinary, such as, for example, citing the government's failure to stop persistent flooding in Jeddah, citing government incompetence in dealing with this, citing even low-level government corruption, can end you up in jail.
So, for example, anybody that criticized the way the authorities handled the stampede at the recent Hajj, where they kept insisting only a few hundred people were killed when over 2,000 were killed. And I think to this day they still insist on that. And apparently it was provoked by some member of the royal family who showed up with a huge entourage and upset the entire flow of these millions of people. If you were to say, you know, that the Saudi authorities mishandled this, that's enough. I mean, they've really written the rules, haven't they, in a way that suppresses any form of dissent by the sound of it.
No, I mean, absolutely. And I'm just going to read here to you directly from the counterterrorism law. So crimes that are defined as terrorism are any acts, which of course includes speech, that is, now you understand this, intended to disturb the public order or shake the security of the state or the stability of the state or expose its national unity to danger or insult the reputation of the state, or attempt to force a governmental authority to carry out inaction. So if you call on the government saying, I want you to stop doing this or to start doing this, we want to force you to do something differently, then you're guilty of terrorism. The crimes with which Nimit and Nimit is charged are not recognizable as crimes in sort of the in any way that's understood in international law as a recognizable crime.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Whitson, who's the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North Africa Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. So how much do you think this is going to affect the Saudi government, the royal family, the Al Saud family, get their legitimacy from being the custodians of the holy shrines of Islam, and they have a compact with the Wahhabi sect that dominates the practice of religion both in Saudi Arabia and have spread their influence throughout the world and have had demonstrable effects on making Islam in many ways more anti-Western, more xenophobic, less tolerant. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But the one thing that is a part of their legitimacy is that they are the custodians of the shrines and that all Muslims in their lifetime are supposed to do the Hajj, the pilgrimage. And so now they've cut flights with Iran. They are so anti-Shia that it's pretty hard to me to imagine that Shiite Muslims are going to show up. So doesn't that sort of bring into question the whole idea of them being custodians of the shrines, and if they start deciding which Muslims can come and which can't?
Well, I mean, sure, absolutely. I mean, part of the challenge, of course, is of the division and the animosity right now that is being propagated between Sunni and Shia, to the point where some extremist Sunnis don't see Shia as legitimate Muslims entitled to visit the shrines, is probably at an all-time high. And it's obviously tragic. It's obviously very sad to most people in the outside world. Understanding the differences between these sects are as significant today as understanding the differences between, you know, Methodists and Protestants or Catholics and Protestants. You know, certainly there are differences, but ultimately, to the outside world, they're just Christians, and it's tragic that this sort of division is being deliberately conflated, because I think at the heart of this, both for Saudi Arabia and Iran, are really questions of political, territorial, and geographic dominance, that they are conveniently using religious schisms to justify as a pretext for what are pretty basic, bald political maneuvers for power.
So in the work that you do then, Sarah Whitson, is there any indication in your dealings with Saudi officials that is it just a wall that you're up against? There's obviously no remorse, but they basically say this is our rights, our customs, and you can't interfere with us. And they appear to close the door on everything. So how do you, for example, persuade them not to execute the blogger and not to execute the Palestinian poet?
Well, I think it's much more complicated and nuanced, and there's a public face that the Saudi government, you know, with a bit of bravado might show, but the reality is they are deeply concerned about their image. The world community is now increasingly a very small place with the presence of international media 24/7 that Saudis fortunately still do have access to. And the reality is the government is so sensitive to its international image that it spends over $100 million in boosting its image with PR firms, primarily in the United States and the UK, and is so sensitive to criticism that, for example, it's passed a law in Saudi Arabia making it a crime to compare Saudi Arabia to ISIS. You know, this is clearly getting under their skin. And the fact is that international approbation does make a difference because, as you recall, Raif Badawi was sentenced to 1,000 lashes. But after the first two lashing sessions where videos surreptitiously taken of his lashings leaked out to the international world, they quietly stopped the lashings because they could not stand the condemnation, the criticism, the horror, the shock of what Saudi Arabia was doing, which is inflicting violence on a journalist whose words they didn't like, and the comparisons to what ISIS or Al-Qaeda were doing to journalists was just too hard to avoid for them, so they couldn't do it. They have to bow to international outrage and pressure because they're part of the international community whether they want to be or not.
But obviously it's one thing to put a public relations fig leaf over what you're doing, and there's another thing to deal honestly with what the problem is, which the rest of the world, or most of the world, has with this medieval government, which is that they're back in the 14th century, that it's an absolute monarchy with no rights to any citizens at all. And as you've made clear, these arbitrary anti-terrorism laws essentially give the government total rights to do anything with anybody under any pretext.
At a broad level, that's true. On the micro level, it's, of course, much more complicated than that, because like any society, Saudi Arabia is a complicated place. The challenge is that decision-making is concentrated in the hands of such few people who are not necessarily the experts and not necessarily the most knowledgeable. The opportunity and the advantage is that there is a class of well-educated Saudis who have lived around the world, who do understand the realities of the world, and who want their country to join the 21st century. And the government has to also keep them happy, has to also win their support and their faith. And those are the people who we can count on to push harder for Saudi Arabia to act differently. And so there are many in Saudi Arabia who are very, not just unhappy, but highly embarrassed with the conduct of their government. And I think particularly the war in Yemen has caused quite a bit of rankling inside even the royal family, where there is, you know, open discussion about the divisions in the royal family, the criticisms in the royal family of the new leadership, and their foolhardy, reckless plunging into this war in Yemen, which is only going to exacerbate not just tensions but the humanitarian catastrophe, and of course the reputation of Saudi Arabia being involved in a war that it clearly has no control over, particularly in seeing what the outcomes are going to be. And we work with those who are the most enlightened, are the most knowledgeable, who recognize and understand that for the interests of their own society, for their own state, for their own longevity, there need to be reforms ultimately in the kingdom. The challenge, of course, is they have the riches, the gifts of such great wealth and resources that the government has been able to buy off the quiescence of a large chunk of its population. And they are on a very delicate balancing act to that end.
But my understanding is that there's not much reliable polling. And when you said earlier, Sarah Whitson, that the Saudis have now made it a crime to compare the Saudi government, the Al-Saud family, with ISIS, I'd heard that the majority of Saudi youth actually support ISIS, that the Wahhabi influences, you know, in this peculiar schizophrenic arrangement that the royals have with the religious authorities, who essentially, you know, have the religious police keep everybody in line, that there may well be, I mean, you hear two schools of thought about the youth, and this country has a youth bulge, there's no question about it, that some just chafe under the Mutawa, under the religious police, they can't date, they can't do anything, they're all savvy with social media, but they're totally frustrated on the one hand, and then the other hand, there's a lot of sympathy for the Islamic State. So what does your polling tell you?
Well, we don't have any polling. I don't think anyone has any polling, and I don't think anybody could tell us with any degree of confidence or accuracy what most Saudis think or most Saudis believe, because we don't really know. Polling is actually not allowed in Saudi Arabia and in most of the Middle East. And there's no doubt that there's some sympathy for extremist Islamist groups in a way that is religiously motivated, in a way that's politically motivated, in a way that's sort of the typical cowboy Rambo ignorance motivated that you find in every society, in every sort of bravado-oriented male machismo society, including in the United States. But there are obviously a great many Saudis who are terrified of ISIS because ISIS and Al-Qaeda before them have targeted the Saudi state as their primary enemy, and numerous terrorist attacks have taken place in Saudi Arabia. So there's a real threat to their own security and stability. I can't imagine that most Saudis believe that the conduct of ISIS is a good thing, because ISIS is a declared enemy of Saudi Arabia as well.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, given that sectarian tensions have been heightened by Saudi Arabia's execution of this prominent Shia cleric, and Iran has retaliated, the embassy was burned, Saudi embassy was burned in Tehran, and all kinds of recriminations and hostility is now starting to emerge, and other countries have joined in, cutting diplomatic ties, Sudan and Bahrain, where there is a Shia majority, who are very, very oppressed as far as I can tell. So if there is a weakness in the leadership, you've got a King Salman who's apparently got Alzheimer's, his son is apparently has never been educated abroad, and that there is dissent, as you mentioned, within the ruling ranks. They're alarmed at how much money is going out the window as they burn through their reserves because of the low price of oil. And at this war in Yemen is backfiring. So there's a lot of concern about the young Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the 30-year-old who's apparently running the country. Is there any sense, just in closing, that the rest of the royals, the more Western modern ones that you mentioned, that are embarrassed by Saudi Arabia's government's behavior, could they intervene, do you think?
It's really hard to say or predict with any confidence. I mean, the other challenge is that many of the more liberal broad-minded Saudi Arabias have unfortunately been forced and compelled to have a plan B. They have dual nationalities, they have homes in other countries, they have bank accounts outside the country, they're ready to evacuate at any moment. And that, I think, is actually a great misfortune, because they're not as deeply invested in changing their country as they should be. They have the option of cutting and running in a way that the average Saudi doesn't. And that is part of the dilemma that keeps Saudi stuck, is that those who can change don't have enough skin in the game to force a change.
Well, Sarah Whitson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Whitson, who's Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Middle East and North African Division, where she oversees 19 countries with staff located in 10 countries. She has led dozens of advocacy and investigative missions throughout the region, focusing on issues of armed conflict, accountability, legal reform, migrant workers, and political rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can contact me and also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.